Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, host of this hour of medical news, science and healthcare in the news, a little bit of politics this week because of what's going on in Congress, and answers to your questions and emails about all of the above. All that and more on Ask Dr. Dawn. So, before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for professional consultation. Well, I think that I'll start with just talking about Chairman Ryan's plan. This is the House Budget Committee, Paul Ryan, who is, would you believe, a Republican. And the proposed 2012 budget released on Tuesday had a lot about health care in it. So just briefly, this plan would reduce taxes for corporations and individuals by $4.2 trillion, and it would transition the Medicare program toward the private sector. It would do that by having a voucher system where every Medicare enrollee would receive a voucher, a coupon, basically, that they could go and spend on an insurance product. And of course, they might not have an insurance product out there that would cover all of their healthcare costs. But it's essentially moving the administration to the private sector. More about that in a second. It would also reduce the Medicaid funding across the United States by about $771 billion and create a system of state block grants. What the budget doesn't do is make any provision for the growth of populations in those states, particularly poor populations, and how that might affect healthcare services. On the good side, it does eliminate, it eliminates all standards for what services need to be provided by Medicaid because they make it a block grant. So it's up to the state to decide whether or not you would, for example, cover abortions for poor women, or whether or not you would cover, well, anything, chemotherapy, bone marrow transplants, renal dialysis, I guess, though I'm not sure about that one. What does this mean? Well, it represents a real pushback from the healthcare funding reform passed a couple of years ago. And it's what happens when you open the box. All the little bugs fly out and start flying around. And it is, I think, a disastrous plan, in my opinion. And I'm particularly worried about the transfer of funding to the private sector. Historically, the private sector has not had a good track record. It's engaged in taking profits from money that was designated for healthcare. The best of the commercial health plans still have overhead and marketing, which includes marketing costs, which, of course, Medicare doesn't have to advertise. But if you are competing for Medicare funding dollars, you're going to have to advertise. And the money that's spent on advertising doesn't get spent on healthcare. The money that's spent on middle management and administrators doesn't get spent on healthcare. And the money that's sent to Wall Street doesn't get spent on healthcare. And in the commercial world, that adds up to as much as 30% of the actual money. So I'm not quite exactly sure how this works out to anything more than corporate welfare, and I'm certainly interested in paying close attention to this debate. It's very ideological, and as you know, it's very much divided along party lines. It's sort of interesting to watch it if you think of it as a football or a rugby match, but when people's lives and their access to healthcare is at stake, it's not really much fun. I'd be interested in your comments, particularly if you are on Medicare or Medicaid, if you currently are receiving healthcare primarily funded by the government. What's your perspective about what's wrong with the current system? Do you see this as having the potential to improve it? And your opinions will be listened to respectfully. So if you want to call in and talk about it, I'd love to hear from you. Let's go to an email. This one from Zoe in Washington, D.C. My fiancé has exercise-induced anaphylaxis. It started 12 years ago while he was running at Michigan State. He got mono, with the coaches knew but didn't tell him, so he continued to run. On multiple occasions, he got so bad that he was EpiPenned. Now, what happens in exercise-induced anaphylaxis for my audience is that histamine is released massively from the mast cells in the skin and lungs. This causes asthma, wheezing, hives, and low blood pressure or vascular collapse. That's the shock part of the anaphylaxis. My fiance currently takes allergy medicine and an over-the-counter antacid, which is apparently also used to treat EIA, every day. But I would hardly say the condition is controlled. Vigorous exercise or even an unseasonably cold day will cause him to break out in hives. He still runs, but only after taking large doses of medication, which doesn't always work, and he won't even consider swimming. Do you know of any alternative treatments for EIA? I've heard that acupuncture can help. I know that some cases of EIA are thought to be connected to food allergies. And while there's no evidence that my fiancé's condition is connected to food, he hasn't really done a food elimination diet to test it. He's also heard that doing an extensive cleanse has cleared up the condition for some people. He's been living with EIA for a long time, but has recently become more frustrated because running has become an important part of my life. At this point, he's willing to try basically anything. Is there anything you can recommend? Yes, indeed, Zoe, I have several recommendations for you and your fiancé. The first one is continue to use the two different histamine blockers that he's using. One is an H1 blocker, and that would be a standard antihistamine like someone with hay fever might use. The second one is probably cimetidine, which is Tagamet by trade name, and this is an H2 blocker. There are two kinds of histamine blockers in the skin, only one kind as it happens in the nose, but you need both if you're getting hives from exercise. Another thing that he should strongly consider is chromalyn sodium. That's C-R-O-M-O-L-Y-N. Chromalyn stabilizes the mast cells, so it will reduce the amount of inflammation in his lungs and the histamine in his lungs, which would help with the wheezing and the chest tightness that he's probably experiencing. But more importantly, inhaled chromalyn delivered via a nebulizer will probably penetrate into the general bloodstream. And unfortunately, this stuff does not get in orally, so it can't be taken in pill form. But inhaled chromalyn will probably get to some of the mast cells in his skin via the bloodstream and therefore stabilize them as well. So it's really an important thing for him to try. And the nice thing about chromalyn is there's effectively no overdose. It can be used in high doses. It can be given by nebulization, so he can get one of those little asthma inhaler things and take it. And it does cross into the circulation via the alveoli. So that's something I would strongly recommend. And that's a pharmaceutical, as insurance will probably pay for it. When I read something like this with my new functional medicine sensibility, I immediately think in terms of the concept of upregulation of the immune system. The idea that maybe it's food sensitivities, but I would be much more suspicious of a dysbiosis. In other words, bacteria that are living in your fiance's body could be the sinuses, probably the intestines, but there are other places, the roots of the teeth, for example. But somewhere there's bacteria that are not commensals. They're not friendly bacteria. They're actually unfriendly bacteria. And holding them in check is activating the immune system. So in a situation like this, doing a elimination cleanse, whatever you want to call it, where one takes herbal antibacterials and re-inoculates with lots of antibiotics and checking for food allergies, both IgE and IgG, as in got to have G checked in your fiance, would be very, very useful. There are a number of labs that will do this, and I would urge you to go to the functionalmedicine.org website and use their physician finder. I am morally certain that there are physicians in every major metropolitan area, and Washington, D.C. is definitely a major metropolitan area. So I hope that you will seek out additional guidance, but those are some initial thoughts. And for anyone who has generalized allergic type reactions to exercise, it is very, very important to understand that your immune system is activated and it's being activated by something. The natural downregulation isn't happening. So going in search of that and eliminating what it is that is activating the immune system is likely to improve or even completely eliminate your symptoms. It is so critical that you not stop at the drugs and the pharmaceuticals, which stop the reaction, but don't get to the source. Got to go after the source here. Well, we didn't get much of a reaction from the discussion we did on radiation, except for one email from Tony in Santa Cruz. And Tony basically fired me. Didn't like what I had to say about the current situation not meriting us panicking and going off and taking radioactive iodine. Sorry about that, Tony, and I would respect your opinion. And as far as the concept of what does one do in a non-nuclear free world, we all live in a nuclear free zone here in the Monterey Bay, but we can't control what happens in Japan. We can't even control what happens in Diablo Canyon or San Onofre. And in the event of one of these plants actually melting down, we know what happens. We see it in Chernobyl. A good article appeared in Truthout. The author is Barbara Rose Johnston with a T, and it was dated Monday, April 4th, 2011. Waking Up to a Nuclear Nightmare. You can find that on truthout.org. It's a editorial piece talking about what we should be doing as a people to demand greater transparency and more honesty from our government. And I think that that is a well-thought-out opinion piece that's worth reading. I'm not going to offer any kind of further opinions on radiation today because we have so much more to talk about, but I do think that we will look into doing that for a future show. Right now, we're going to go to a person responding to my invitation, and that is John in Santa Cruz. Hello, John, and welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have three pieces of what you might term equipment, a low back brace, a custom-made ankle brace, and some inserts and things like that. They were all given to people under the prescription of Medicare. Whenever I ask people how much they think these things cost, the low back brace, they go, $50. They charge Medicare $568. For the orthotic inserts for this person who had an ankle issue, they say, maybe $5. The inserts were $150, but they had to have these special shoes, which everybody thinks may be $45, which were $250.
Mm-hmm.
The custom-made orthotic ankle brace, which she wore twice, and she couldn't wear it anymore because it hurt so much, it was $1,700. So I don't know how you could control something like that. It's just outrageous, the costs for some of these.
It brings to mind the $2,000 toilet,
hammer. Yeah.
The toilet
yeah.
seat from the military yeah. budget that was like $2,000 or something when they looked at the military. Yeah, then one of the arguments that the, let's call it the right wing makes about big government is these ridiculous costs that contractors essentially get for items that we all know we could go out and buy on the street for considerably less.
Yeah,
yeah, and I have to tell you, I don't understand it. Because I look at my reimbursement from Medicare, and it's full of perverse incentives. You know, just speaking as a primary care doctor, management, E&M codes, evaluation and management codes. Let's suppose I see someone who has hypertension, diabetes, and they also have a small spot on their cheek that's precancerous. Well, the documentation and time that it takes, first of all, to manage diabetes and hypertension. It takes some effort. You have to be a good psychologist. You have to get the patient to take the pills. You have to get them to change their diet. It's a lot of work. And I'm not just assumed to do the work. I actually have to fill out a fairly complicated kind of charting that proves that I, you know, reviewed these problems, did a review of systems of at least three systems, examined at least three things, looked at level of complexity, and all of that to get my $48. From Medicare for a level two visit. Sorry, that's a level three visit. Now, in the meantime, that precancerous skin lesion I mentioned to you,
yep.
$78 for a literally 1 minute freeze with liquid nitrogen. And they pay.
So do you think we should switch from fee for service to time?
Well, you know what would happen if we did that? What did Ross Perot say about that trade act, the giant sucking sound would be heard as all the jobs went to Mexico. Well, there would be a giant collective scream from every surgical subspecialty you can think of, because the surgical subspecialists make more money and they have lifestyles and careers, and you know, they've been promised via a social contract a certain level of reimbursement for their work. And if you switch to time, you would cut these people's income by, you know, 70-80%. The amount of pushback you would get, and the amount of screaming, and the amount of the administrative organisms of collective medicine, like the AMA and the CMA, would be, because they are collective entities, obligated to go to bat and put all of their forces against any such, you know, re-rationalization of the system. So, I think I would like it because I would be advantaged by it. But I also have to say that that kind of brute force change isn't likely to occur, and we're going to waste a lot of energy trying to make it happen through that sort of brute force confrontational approach. How do we make it work is a very big question, because what we've currently got is a system of perverse incentives where cost containment simply cannot be achieved. And we've got an aging population. And I heard last night on, I forget which program it was, I think On Point, but I'm not certain, where they were talking about the demographics, and that we're currently at 70% of the children in education are non-white, and something like 70% of the people who are going to be wanting their health care and their social security paid for by these children when they are graduated from school and working are white, and how we have this class race war stacking up over the next 20 years. And it feeds into this discussion of healthcare policy.
Yes, it does. I guess that's all I really wanted to mention was the cost of those particular items billed to Medicare. And incidentally, on your show, I think it was on the Saturday, the 26th, the gentleman that you had on who was giving a lot of information, I could barely keep up writing with all the information. It was very, very good. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And of course, you can always download the podcast and hit your pause button on your computer while you listen to it in case you missed anything. The podcast is at AskDrDon.com, and that is up and can be downloaded anytime.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome. And just to remind you all, every program is posted usually within the week after it's done, unless we have some technical issue that slows us down further. And we have the program broken up so that you can only download certain segments of it. You don't have actually to do the whole thing. You can do the sort of light version of the topics you're interested in. While we're on the issue of the website, I do want to mention that we have now got a Twitter and Facebook presence, and I am actively tweeting and publishing blogs and commentary on technical subjects that we do cover on the program. You can just go to AskDrDon.com, www.AskDrDon.com, and use the Twitter and Facebook buttons. So I hope to pick up more friends. And just an announcement, if you are local and you're a Facebook friend, you can ask for and receive a 5% discount on any services I do. So, hey, it's actually a reason to be on Facebook. How about that? Let's go to Dave in Boulder Creek. Hello, Dave, and welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going?
How are you?
I'm great today.
Yeah.
So I actually have several comments about pretty much everything you've talked about today has been of interest to me. The first one being that I'm 50 years old right now, and I've been an athlete my entire life, a runner and a bike racer. And about 20 years ago, all of a sudden, I had onset exercise-induced anaphylaxis. It was amazing. Like, I probably had this occur maybe a dozen times, and I probably ended up in the hospital about five times. And I subsequently started carrying an EpiPen and Benadryl with me everywhere I went. This lasted for about 5 years, and then all of a sudden it just stopped. I have not had an occurrence of this in about 15 years, and I have no idea why.
Well, I would suggest that probably around the time it stopped, you took a course of antibiotics. You didn't think about it because, you know, it wasn't related. You had a tooth abscess, you had a skin infection. but it wiped out something that had been stimulating your immune system. This is a non-provable hypothesis, so we couldn't do the experiment to prove it. We're certainly not going to try to reinfect you and see if we can get the thing going around
right.
again so we can eradicate it. But I think it's a solid hypothesis in terms of accounting for the phenomenon and working with the types of triggers that we currently know exist. The fact is that people travel all the time. They might pick up a parasite. They might pick up a gastroenteritis, a turista or something like that on a trip to Mexico. And you're not going to connect that with the development of exercise-induced anaphylaxis 3 to 6 months later. Who would?
Right.
And certainly your doctor's not going to make the connection because this is completely off of conventional medicine's evangelizing.
Yeah, at the time, the whole concept of EIA was not really recognized by anyone.
Well, it was recognized in, you know, specialty centers, and if you found yourself an immunologist at Stanford or something, but in terms of the people doing primary care or in emergency room medicine, no. It's just a phenomenon, and here is your EpiPen.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so the second thing I want to talk about, if you don't mind me taking the time, is social medicine. That's a really touchy subject for me because I'm a high-income person. I work in high-tech, and I have been paying into Medicare and Social Security for my entire life. And I think that, as I said, I'm 50 years old, and then in 12, 15 years, when I'm ready to retire, I think, yes, I definitely deserve to get back what I've paid in. And secondly, I do not mind at all helping others who have not been as fortunate as I am. And I just think that, well, I think the government needs to do a better job of managing its money and have these silos of money. This is put away for this, and that's put away for that. And anyway, that's just a general malaise.
Well, let me ask you a question about your health care. You're a high-end earner, so you have decent health insurance.
Right.
How much of your cost comes out of your pocket versus your employer?
I don't pay anything.
All right, so you're like a member of Congress, essentially,
okay.
who basically has free, good health care. You're satisfied with your insurance, happy with it?
Very definitely, yes.
Okay. And have you had any major illnesses in the last 5 years?
No.
Okay. So you're a healthy person. All of this money, which would have gone into your salary or into your retirement or stock options, but instead went into the insurance industry, effectively, for this healthy 50-year-old guy who hasn't gotten sick, so he hasn't taken anything out. And that money has, 70% of it has gone to pay for healthcare for other people, and 30% of it has gone to overhead for the company that is administering the services. It could be as low as 18%. I think that's the best of the private plans that are out there, and the worst is 35%. So let's, you know, call it 25%. That's our current situation. We are wasting money in that area, and we've also got the situation that most of the cost of durable goods is actually going through these companies, and they're getting leverage discounts, which are literally 90% off of the price that Medicare is paying. The guy who called earlier and was mentioning the, what was it, the $400 custom orthotic, or maybe it was even more than that. Well, this sort of thing doesn't happen for these health plans. These health plans get good, solid prices from their vendors, because they play hardball with their vendors, something that the right. United States government will not do. It doesn't play hardball with their vendors because the vendors are bribing the congressmen not to play hardball. To fix our health system, we actually need campaign finance reform. We can't fix our healthcare system without campaign finance reform. We just can't. It won't happen. And we're in danger of making it even worse and more distorted if we don't get that in place first. Because the companies already know how to play hardball. And if we don't play hardball back at the government level, like they do in France, like they do in Germany, like they do in Canada, we can't bring ourselves to make the corporations actually pay.
So someone like me is just pure profit for the insurance companies.
Yeah, they love you. But I tell you something, don't you dare leave your job and go try to do a startup, because you are a 50-year-old male. So the odds that something might actually happen to you in the next 15 years are pretty good. You might develop a cancer, you might develop a heart attack. It doesn't matter how healthy you are. The law of statistics for 50-year-old males says that these are a poor risk, even if they have a great track record. So you would have a hard time getting insurance on your own.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've, God help you, if you've ever taken an antihistamine, because if you're on the record as being allergic, you're practically uninsurable and you'll never...
Wow, really?
Yeah, it's nuts. It's nuts, the sort of pre-existing conditions that they can exclude you for or pump you into a high-cost category.
Okay. So the final thing I want to talk about quickly is time-based treatment. And the reason that struck a chord is because the doctor that I have in Santa Cruz is the most amazing, awesome doctor you could possibly imagine. You go into his office, and miraculously, he's always on time, and he takes you into his office, and first you sit down, and he talks to you and says, what's the problem? And you have a conversation, and then he says, okay, is there anything else bothering you? No. And then you go into the examining room, and he looks at whatever is, you know, bothering you, and then you come back into his office and sit down and have another conversation about these are the options. So he spends like 30 minutes, or really as much time as I would need, and I think that guy deserves so much more money than and so much more credit than you know, the average guy who brings you in there 15 minutes in and out.
Oh, 15 minutes is actually long. If you talk to people, that's...
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's true.
So I feel very lucky that I found this guy.
Okay. Well, hats off to your doctor. If you want to out him and say his name and tell him how much you love him on the air, I'm fine with that.
I'll do that. His name is Carl Josens.
All right. Well, hats off to Dr. Josens.
All right.
Thank you very much for your call.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Credit where credit is due, right? And we're going to talk now to Simon in SoCal. Hello, Simon, and welcome to the program.
Hooray for Medicare. I love Medicare, too. Yeah, it got me through a stroke. It got me through replacing a knee. It got me through cancer. All with nothing. No side pay at all.
Copay, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because I happened to fall in an economic slot that allowed me for Medi-Cal. And I'm hoping before any of these jerks start messing it around to get a new shoulder and another new knee.
Well, I think you've got time.
Yeah.
I don't think any changes are going to happen that quickly. 2014 has some initial changes, but the sort of thing that they're talking about with the block grants and the voucher system for Medicare are going to be a very, very long time in the future. I'd say 5 years at the inside just to get something like that figured out and implemented. You know, yes, there's time. It's a little bit like fiddling while Rome burns, though. And, you know, I really think that there is something to be said for the feedback loop of knowing what it costs, even if you don't have to pay it.
Yeah.
Because I think some of the costs are pretty crazy. And certainly the cost structures are nuts and need to be addressed. The perverse incentives need to be taken out of Medicare. So Medicare for All as a kind of campaign slogan is great. But when you get down to the practical details, we really need Medicare version 2.0 for all.
Yes, if the those folks who run Medicare would do, as you say, start playing hardball with the suppliers.
Yeah, I was very disappointed.
Not the doctors, of course.
Well, they've already played hardball with us.
Yeah,
of course. That's the thing.
You're
There's
the most
no
vulnerable.
Well, they've played plenty of hardball with us. Basically, we can't get anything from Medicare because every year they hold this thing over our heads that we're going to finally implement the Affordable Care Act, which was from the 1980s. And we're going to do it retroactively, so we're going to cut everything by 25%. Or we won't do that, but don't ask for anything else.
Yeah.
So they've been playing that game for, oh gosh, I'd say at least a decade now. And every year it comes up and it goes to the brink. And last year they actually temporarily reduced our rates by about 25%. Then they rethought that and pushed through this sort of emergency hallelujah, Hail Mary pass thing through Congress, which has become part of the annual ritual.
They've got all the marbles.
Well, yeah. Not then they own the court and the hoops. But as a society, we've got to solve this. I mean, there's just no question. And piecemeal solutions are not going to solve it. And pointing fingers and yelling at each other is not going to solve it. And what's at stake is the health and welfare of an entire generation. So we have to solve
this.
So
short-sighted, my heavens.
Well, I'm glad for you and that you have been in the right place at the right time. and have had your needs met as any citizen of an industrialized nation has a right to expect.
You think?
Yeah, I do. And I'm a little envious of you, quite frankly, but that's but I'm also proud that we've at least achieved partial human rights for in this country on the matter of healthcare.
Indeed, yeah. Well, you have to be, who has said that the rich have everything, the poor get everything they need, and the middle class have to pay?
I don't know who said that, but that's not a bad way of saying it.
Yeah.
All right, but I would disagree that the poor get everything they need. Thank you.
You have to beg.
Yes. Well,
okay, thank you, Dr. Dawn.
Bye, and keep listening, okay?
Sure.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's go to Ellen in Monterey. Hello, Ellen, and welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you very much for your program. It's a great program. I'm calling in about the Medicare discussion to keep that going.
Okay.
And I've always wondered, since we have tiered taxes, depending on people's income, why we can't, how do I put it? We've all put in our Medicare dollars as we've worked, but why can't the wealthy people have less of a Medicare input than those who really need it? Why can't it be based upon our taxes?
I'm not sure what exactly you're advocating. Can you elaborate a little bit?
I guess what it would end up coming out of is Social Security, like a deduction from Social Security for those who don't need the money as much for Medicare coverage, so that Medicare could be fully funded for those who really need it and for those who are more fortunate, since we don't seem to want to raise their taxes. Perhaps they could pay for more of their medical expenses.
Okay, so what I'm seeing is some kind of means test so that...
Exactly.
Yeah, so...
If, with taxes.
Right, so a sliding scale, effectively, but a reverse sliding scale.
Exactly.
So the cost to the individual who is, let's say, well-heeled... Let's pick a big number. Let's say that your retirement income is $100,000 a year.
Okay.
In retirement. So a person in that bracket would perhaps pay for all of their, let's say, their doctor's visits, and only major medical under Medicare would be covered, but they would get the, I'm just thinking out loud here, I'm not seriously making a proposal, I'm just, you know, doing a thought experiment. So what would happen would be they would get the Medicare prices because they're over 65, but the actual reimbursement from Medicare wouldn't kick in until perhaps a certain share of cost had been met. Kind of like
Like a deductible.
Kind of like an annual deductible.
Right.
So you get the Medicare price, but you don't start to get Medicare actually covering your costs until you've crossed, say, $10,000 for the year. I'm just, again, picking a high deductible number. So then once you cross the $10,000, you kick in your full Medicare, because $100,000 a year, that's 10% of your income for the year. That's plenty. You know, that's plenty.
That kind of an idea, because obviously we call ourselves a civilized country, and so we help take care of people who haven't been so fortunate. Be one way to cover these mounting expenses for aging population.
Right. Well, I think it's a reasonable approach. I have one objection, which is that the next presidential election is slated to be the most expensive presidential election in history. Our president recently attended a $35,000 a plate fundraising dinner. My jaw dropped when I saw that. $35,000 a plate. So who do you think is buying those plates? It's definitely not people in the lower income brackets. It's the people who you would be taking something away from under this plan.
Mm-hmm.
So any rational health care plan, as I said earlier in the program, has to be predicated on campaign finance reform. If we don't have campaign finance reform, it will be impossible to take anything away from the corporations or anything away from the rich. And so the only people who can have things taken away from them would be the poor and the middle class, who are running out of things to raid. And everybody knows that, but because we have a system that doesn't allow for us to go after the rich or go after the corporations, you know, it simply can be blocked too easily through our campaign system.
Well, I agree with that. I don't know how possible it never be something that actually gets on the table, but we're not also running out of things to take away from the poor. If all these states with conservative governors have their way, they want to take away from bargaining rights for labor unions. They certainly want to make it nearly impossible for women who become pregnant, only 50% responsible for that pregnancy. They want to take away their right to end an unwanted pregnancy.
And not only that, but they're also really going after those women's rights not to get pregnant in the first place.
Yep.
So it's like, excuse me, but that's just, isn't that the most ultimate anti-female thing you can do? It's like, well, we won't help you not get pregnant, and we won't help you when you are.
And I think it wouldn't and be we won't help if men feed the were the baby. Ones that got pregnant.
And we won't help feed the baby either. So there. Okay, well, I think we're on the same side of the table and have run out of things to talk about, Ellen.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you very much for your comments. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And I'm going to shift gears a little bit and take some more emails. This one from Lonnie in Santa Cruz. Lonnie is 70 years old, using tramadol for years to relieve back pain, and has thus persistent constipation problems, using milk of magnesia, but it bubbles through the digestive system. And he's found that magnesium capsules, 400 milligrams twice daily, work well. But he's wondering if high doses of magnesium might create a problem. I would say, Lonnie, you can take magnesium orally up to about 2,000 milligrams a day, as long as you have normal renal function. To the extent that the magnesium is making your bowels work better, it's probably because that portion of the magnesium is not even being absorbed into your body. With respect to people with impaired renal function and constipation, I don't recommend the use of magnesium, but flaxseed ground up is an excellent substitute, and it has combined bulking and stimulatory effects. And I have become a real convert for using ground flaxseed to deal with either chronic or intermittent constipation issues. So put a little useful health tip out there. And speaking of health tips, this is an internet program for people out there who have babies and are having problems with the baby sleeping through the night, or having, you know, young children, again, who aren't sleeping through the night, and thus the parents themselves are having issues. Johnson & Johnson has a great website called Customized Sleep Profile. And we went ahead and put the link on the Ask Dr. Don website under resources, so you can go and look for it there. The web address is really easy. It's www.johnsonsbaby.com/sleep. And there is a link on our resources website, as I said. Reason I'm announcing this is that I came across an actual scientific study with a placebo group where this customized sleep profile was actually validated to show that it improved sleep. They had 90% of the mothers who were in the internet intervention group found the recommendations helpful and were likely to keep using them. In terms of the actual scoring, the number of night wakings in children decreased by 50% or more by following the recommendations in the personalized profile. And the longest period of uninterrupted sleep increased by more than 2 hours. Children fell asleep faster and had longer total sleep time, which means the parents had longer total sleep time. And would you be surprised to learn that the parents reported feeling less tension, depression, fatigue, and confusion? So, a validated technique for improving infant and young children's sleep. Let's go there. That's www.johnsonsbaby.com/sleep. And let's go to our next caller. That is Doug in Santa Cruz. Hello, Doug, and welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to talk about, the alternative medications that people take. I wanted to ask you what you think will happen with that. Say, like, for example, someone takes St. John's wort rather than a normal prescription type of antidepressant.
What do I think will happen?
Yeah, I mean, is there any chance that those kinds of things will be able to be prescribed?
I'm giving you my...
Probably about $200 or $300 a month on supplements, and I'm on a fixed income.
Right.
And I'm on Medicaid.
Right.
So it's a big expense out of my
pocket
to pay for it that way, rather than going for, you know, the standard medication.
Uh-huh.
Because I'm healthier this way. I know I am.
Right. Okay. I understand what you're saying. Now, let me tell you a little fable. All right. Once upon a time, there was a compound called fish oil.
Uh-huh.
omega-3 fatty acids. If you're a regular listener, you may have heard me discuss them before. And these omega-3 fatty acids were shown in many scientific studies to be effective at all sorts of things: lowering blood pressure, lowering cholesterol, improving cognitive functioning in people with dementia. And lo, it became possible on the event horizon of the drug companies to say, we need an omega-3 fatty acid product. And so what happened was that a drug company went out and developed an omega-3 fatty acid product, which is EPA and DHA, that's purified. It's just as good as what you can buy from Nordic Naturals around the corner at the health food store. But they went through the validation process with the FDA, the great federal bureaucracy, which has all of these rules and hoops you have to jump through in order to validate a substance. So they went and they validated this substance. And in doing so, they spent a lot of money. And as a reward for all of the money they spent, they were given a 17 years exclusive patent on a natural substance called omega-3 fatty acids. And it is now a pharmaceutical called Lovasa. It is approved by the FDA to lower triglycerides in people with elevated triglycerides. And your doctor can write a prescription for it. And if you have elevated triglycerides, your insurance company has to pay for it. Its cost? Well, roughly four times the cost of omega-3 fatty acid on the market. So if it ever does get covered, it will get covered through these channels, which means it will become much more expensive automatically because of the validation process that has to be gone through. Or at least
we need to fix the system whereby, you know, companies are granted that, or maybe just make it so that it's more than one company that gets granted. Fix that system, like you said, where we have to change the voting.
Mm-hmm. We might just really have to tweak the concept of, you know, this is being used widely already on the open market, so you don't get to turn it into a drug. There's another one. There are a couple of things that have happened recently. Quinine has been removed. People used to use that for nocturnal leg cramps. Can't get that anymore. Colchicine, which is an old drug around since, gosh, probably the 1930s. It was a great drug for gout, and a lot of people have been using colchicine to control their gout symptoms for literally decades. And just recently, some company came along and said, we are going to make an FDA-validated form. And the FDA has said, you know, we're going to go take all these drugs that are old drugs that have been around forever, and we're going to make you go through this validation process. So a company comes up and says, okay, we'll validate colchicine. And they did. They went through the process, spent the money. Now there is no colchicine except their product, which is called Colchris and costs $70 a month. So little old lady, been paying $10 a month. Now she's paying $70 a month. Same substance, same molecule. They didn't invent the molecule. And I think it's fair. If you invent the molecule, then sure, you can have 17 years patenting on a molecule you invented. But awarding that to people who simply jump through the hoops to validate something which debatably doesn't even need to be validated in the first place because we have so many years of experience with it, that's nuts. And that's a window for exploitation that is just being explored by Big Pharma. And you can expect more things. Like, I wouldn't be surprised at all if St. John's Wort became one of these where it suddenly, well, you have to use the validated form.
Right.
It would be well within.
So really what we need to do is fix the system and the process and really open that up to a higher scrutiny so everyone sees the ridiculousness of it. And then we can just, you know, make that, a more streamlined.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And this is one place where the Europeans have more issues than we do. They have something called the Codex, which I didn't know about you, but the word Codex makes me think of that guy, Dan Brown. So I keep thinking, oh, we've got the Codex here. This is but this Codex is all about nutritional substances. And in Europe, they regulate the dosing that you can use. And their doses that are allowed to be made by the manufacturers are actually quite low. And I mean, I'm used to using nutraceuticals at fairly high doses. Like, for example, if someone has high triglycerides, I might give them niacin, and I'll give them niacin at literally 200 times the recommended daily allowance as a nutritional vitamin. But I'm not using it as a vitamin. I'm using it as a drug. And it's a validated use. And there is, in fact, a pharmaceutical now. So we're in a really crazy place with respect to our laws.
Yeah, and one of the things that you said was he's inventing a molecule. We can't really invent a molecule to begin with because they're all there. It's discovering molecules.
Oh, no, they can invent molecules. They do that all the time. What they'll do is...
I don't understand. I mean,
well,
all
okay,
molecules
let me explain.
Already exist in the universe, so it's a matter of...
No, it's not. You see, you have to have a unique molecule in order to get it patented. So, so like the first statin is lovastatin, Mevacor, and it's derived from, guess what? Red rice yeast.
Yes.
That's the identical molecule. Of course, in red yeast rice, there are other substances. I always reverse those and I say red rice yeast and I should say red yeast rice, which is more correct. But anyway, there are other substances that are similar molecules and maybe they have slightly different properties, but it hasn't been researched that well. But the one molecule, the Mevacor, which is lovastatin, got patented by its discoverer. And then the other companies said, we need one of these blockbuster statin drugs. So they would come along and they would like throw a nitrogen group. You can react something, make the molecule, the backbone molecule, and then throw a hydroxy group somewhere. And now it's a new molecule. And so you have to validate it. You have to validate that it still lowers cholesterol and that it doesn't, you know, cause you to grow three eyeballs or whatever. And once you've done that, then you have the 17-year patent, and then the other guy comes along and he says, well, let's try two hydroxy groups and make sure we don't screw it up. And if they don't, then they get a unique molecule patent as well. So those aren't new molecules. They're generally derived from skeletons that already exist. And of course, they go out and they dig up molds and tree scum and all sorts of things from Central America and wherever they can find molecules, and they run them through processes to try to find new molecules that they can tweak and play with. And that's ongoing pharmaceutical research everywhere. But the idea that you can take something that maybe exists in nature and then play with it to make it unique and then patent it is a big part of how the industry works.
You mean like valerian and valium?
No, those aren't related chemically. All right. Enough of that. Have a great day. Any last words?
Thank you very much for the conversation.
All right, thank you.
I hope things get better.
Me too. All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's go to Gail in Pacific Grove. Hello, Gail. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Yesterday, I had a nuclear heart stress test because I can't do the regular stress test. They injected me with some substances to make my heart race.
They injected you with adenosine.
Yes.
Yes.
And I want to know what I can do to get those isotopes out of my system as fast as possible.
Well, there's two things you can do, and they both involve water. So one of them is pee a lot, and I think you know how to make that happen.
I do.
And you should use a laxative of some kind. Fiber is good. Mm-hmm. And you can maybe use fiber and extra magnesium or some extra flaxseed so that you have multiple bowel movements. Don't give yourself diarrhea, but... you know, maybe you have one bowel movement a day. Let's take it up to three for the next 2 days.
Okay.
And eat some oil. So make sure that you consume oil. That will cause bile to be excreted. And then having the laxatives going, what comes out in the bile is detoxified by the liver. So it's going out of you quickly. And those will be...
Senna work?
Yes, but Senna's not my favorite. It's a stimulatory laxative. You can easily overdo it. And like I said, don't give yourself diarrhea. You just want to poop. And so you poop and you pee and you sweat. And so if you have the opportunity or access to a sauna, some extra sweating would be good.
Okay.
And those are the body's main three ways of eliminating things. And eating some extra fruits and vegetables, maybe a green shake, maybe some sulfur-containing foods like leeks and garlic. This will help your liver conjugate and detoxify the substances, the technetium in this case, and the adenosine for that matter, although adenosine really isn't very toxic. But you can get rid of this stuff by simply improving your body's own natural detoxification. And I want to mention, there is an excellent interview, if I say so myself, but I didn't do most of the talking, so I think I can say so, with Dr. Jeffrey Bland on detoxification on the website at Ask Dr. Dawn. If you go into the archives and you search for the name Dr. Jeffrey Bland, B-L-A-N-D, there is a wonderful discussion of phase one and phase two detoxification and how that whole thing works in our bodies.
It's okay.
Absolutely amazing. And there's lots of helpful advice in terms of, okay, I just had a procedure. I just had to take antibiotics. I just got exposed to all kinds of chemicals because I was stripping furniture or at my house. I moved into a new house and I know the carpet's off gassing. So you can smell it. Well, your body has to deal with that stuff. So improving your body's ability to break down these compounds is really good. It's sensible and it's easily done with natural food substances. You don't even have to go to the health food store.
Oh, I'll look it up.
All right, do that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
We've got just a couple of minutes and I think maybe not enough time to really get into the next call. So I'm going to pick up the theme we began at the beginning of the program and just talk shortly about Provenge. Provenge was recently approved by Medicare and Medicaid that they are going to pay for this. Provenge is a drug for prostate cancer. It is used in advanced prostate cancer, and what it does is it takes pieces of the person's cancer-ridden prostate and makes T cells. It's basically an infusion of immune cells that have been trained in the test tube to attack the cancer. So they take the cancer out, they take your T cells out, they mix it together and use compounds that cause the T cells to become sensitized, then they infuse them back into your body, and now those cells have been trained to go after the cancer. It costs $93,000 to do this, and it adds, are you ready for this? 4 months to the life of men suffering from incurable prostate cancer. They get to live 4 months longer. Medicare gets to spend $93,000. Now, with all due respect to men who are dying from advanced prostate cancer, what kind of crazy is this? This is some kind of crazy. So I hope that we'll be continuing our dialogue next week on this and other interesting issues. And I want to thank you all for listening. This is Dr. Dawn. We've come to the end of another hour, and I want to just say so long and stay healthy. That interview with Jeffrey Bland is dated April 22nd, 2006. It can be found at the Ask Dr. Dawn website. We also have a blog on Facebook, and I tweet regularly. You can find those buttons on the website.